Winthrop is a professor of literature at Clemson University here in South Carolina. He has been until recently an editor of the South Carolina Review, which is a journal of rising distinction for which he is a good deal responsible, I think. He's the author of a number of books, literary criticism and biography, non-deconstructionist literary criticism and biography. Most recently, what will be the definitive work on Glenn Brooks, which is in press at the University of Virginia. Please welcome Mark Winchell.
My paper is entitled The Multiculturalism of M.E. Bradford. In our time, multiculturalism has become a camp phrase of the radical left. It is a banner under which feminists, ethnic minorities, homosexuals, and other self-proclaimed victims of the majority culture demand special recognition and privileged status. Today's multiculturalists all too often advocate a dogmatic, unitary view of American life, one that can only be described as Europhobic. As the Jesse Jackson-led chant at Stanford would have it, hey ho, hey ho, Western culture's got to go. And yet there is an older and more honorable sense in which multiculturalism can be understood. One of the oldest uses of the term that I have found is in Donald Davidson's The Attack on Leviathan, published in 1938. Needless to say, Davidson was not advocating what today's multiculturalists advocate. He was simply urging a tolerance for the folk ways of organic communities. Even if we were no longer a confederation of sovereign states, we could be a nation of mutually tolerant regions. If the South wished to maintain its distinctive way of life, it must allow New England to do the same. The enemy of cultural conformity, Davidson had no desire to teach the Leviathan to eat grits or speak the Southern drawl. In considering the agrarianism of M.E. Bradford, it is perhaps best to start with the influence of Donald Davidson. If Davidson was the most unreconstructed of the Nashville agrarians, Bradford was the most unreconstructed of Davidson's followers. Bradford studied under Davidson at Vanderbilt, defended him against the commissars of political correctness, and tirelessly sought to revive his reputation as a poet. At the time of his death, Bradford was writing a biography of Davidson. In addition to sharing Davidson's abiding love for the South, Bradford also shared his belief that in the life of a people, culture is finally more important than politics. The subjugation of the South by the Federal Army was a military act with political consequences, but it did not impose an alien culture on the conquered territory. At their worst, the Unionists were authoritarians interested only in political control. The totalitarian sensibility, however, insists on controlling the minds and hearts of people as well. In Orwell's 1984, it was not enough to obey Big Brother, one must love him. When this sensibility is linked with the brute power of the police state, we have such abominations as Nazism and communism. But totalitarianism could also wear a benign and genial face. That is what the agrarians discerned in the false promise of industrialism so trenchantly denounced, and I'll take my stand. If conservatism means simply preserving the status quo, none of the agrarians was a conservative. I'll take my stand was written to protest the status quo and to urge a return to earlier values and mores. In a culture far more debased than the one the agrarians encountered, Bradford advocated essentially the same stance. In his book, The Reactionary Imperative, published in 1990, he writes, "Reaction is a necessary term in the intellectual context we inhabit late in the 20th century, because merely to conserve is sometimes to perpetuate what is outrageous. The standard for distinguishing between two kinds of reverence for a tested past can be drawn from the recent behavior of radical federal judges and their apologists, who have the audacity to argue a case for stare decisis with respect to precedents laid down by the High Court under the leadership of Chief Justice Warren." What was needed, Bradford believed, was a willingness to turn back the clock. Unfortunately, too many conservatives were afraid to turn it back any farther than the Cold War 50s. Bradford would have gone them at least a century better. Perhaps the spirit of liberal millennialism was best summed up when Bobby What Kennedy always neglected to mention was that Shaw wrote those lines for the serpent to tempt Eve with in his playbacks of Methuselah. This is the sort of sensibility that Bradford found most dangerous, even when it advocated policies he might find personally congenial. Governments are established among men not to create utopia or even to aid in the upward spiral of history, but only to maintain a certain civic peace. In place of a teleocratic politics of either the left or the right, Bradford defended tradition and organic change. He described himself as a Whig and a Republican, small r. His immediate provenance might have been the American South, but his philosophical roots extended back to the England of Edmund Burke. The heart of Bradford's position was a paradox that can easily be mistaken for a contradiction. How can one advocate a politics of evolution and consensus and yet oppose so much of the actual consensus that has evolved in this country since Appomattox? The solution to this conundrum lies in Bradford's conception of society. To his mind, the notion of a national community is an oxymoron. Only when we are rallying around the flag in time of war does this concept have even a metaphorical plausibility. When we try to legislate for a society larger than the local community, we inevitably deal in abstraction. The larger the polity, the more abstract the legislation. Carried to its logical conclusion, the process of centralization leads to the absurd spectacle of the United Nations trying to enforce the equally absurd principle of international law. Seen in this light, Bradford's antipathy for Abraham Lincoln makes perfect sense. It was Father Abraham who turned a nation of sovereign states into a pagan idol called the Union. What's more, Bradford reminds us, I quote, "Lincoln did not save the Union as it was. Rather, as the scholarship tends to agree, played the central role in transforming it forever into a unitary structure based on a claim to power in its own right, a teleocratic instrument which in the name of any cause that attracts a following might easily threaten the liberties of those for whose sake it existed." End quote. His reverence for organic communities meant that Bradford's literary criticism was regionalist in the best sense of the term. His first loyalty was to the American South as it was defined by the fugitives and agrarians and by a communitarian version of Faulkner. But his interests were not confined to that particular postage stamp of soil. In fact, as a native of Texas and a graduate of the University of Oklahoma, Bradford was Western as well as Southern. Under his trademark Stetson hat, the agrarian vision of social order was leavened by the libertarian spirit of the cowboy. Bradford stressed the cultural importance of art precisely because he did not believe that values could or should be inculcated by government. To the extent possible, civic virtue should be the product of customs, mores, and traditions, rather than the coercive power of the state. By encouraging cultural institutions to serve this vital function, the critic helps remove from government a burden that government is ontologically unsuited to carry. One of Bradford's finest literary essays is a product of his bi-regionalism. In More Freedom Than We Want, Corporate Life and the Literature of the American West, he argues that three important corporate myths shaped the life of 18th and 19th century America. These were the Puritan myth of New England, the Cavalier myth of the South, and the mercantile myth of the Middle Colonies. Curiously enough, the American West held essentially the same significance for the people formed by these three anterior myths. And here again I quote, "Southerners and New Englanders and even commercial men felt about the West as the West qua possibility in more or less the same terms. To be unbounded in space and beyond the definition of familiar institutions was both exhilarating and frightening, or rather first exhilarating and then frightening once one had a taste of nature unimproved." End quote. In this environment, man is either crushed by the hubris of his own isolation or, as in the films Red River and Shade, redeemed in the bosom of a new community. The West, according to Bradford, is a place where a man is always reminded of his own contingency. In his essay, Artists at Home, Frost and Faulkner, Bradford defends literary regionalism against the urban provincials of the Northeastern literary establishment. Speaking of those critics based in Manhattan, he writes, "By and large, they address only one another. Concerning the rest of the Republic, they have only conventional responses, proceeding not from reflection, but from fear, ignorance, and animosity. That this other America, in all its antique multiplicity, should foster or possess serious literature is for them a contradiction in terms." Although his primary target here was Lionel Trilling, particularly in his attempt to turn Frost into a poet of Sophoclean terror, Bradford also mentions the Faulkner criticism of Irving Howe, Alfred Kazin, and Norman Podhoretz. Against the image such criticism fosters of the artist as alienating or rebel, Bradford offers, quote, "an alternative model of the poet, as vatus or memory keeper, craftsman and vessel of prescription, as bard or scop, whom the operation of his imagination assumes fundamental legitimacy in his society," end quote. If Bradford had little regard for much of the criticism emanating from our centers of literary fashion, he was even more contemptuous of the creative works produced there. In his essay, The Social Role of Modern Drama, he argues that the ancient moral function of play acting, with its roots in religious ceremony, had not been well served on Broadway. He saw the American theater as, quote, "either merely commercial or merely ideological, infected by turns with the aesthetic of sentimentality and wishful thinking, or the more potent aesthetic of alienation, an anarchic pseudo-religion destructive of the spirit of social responsibility in any art, especially in performing art," end quote. Bradford goes on to say that, quote, "the economics of the New York stage are such that only private lives can be easily represented on it, two or four characters at the most, a few stereotypes, but no historical ambiance or spectacle. More narrow focus than was encouraged in 1925 by the intellectual climate of Dayton, Tennessee," end quote. To be sure, there were signs of health in the work of such European playwrights as Max Frisch and Eugene Ionesco, and there was always the option of reviving the great plays of the past. But for the most part, Bradford believed that the contemporary stage violated rather than mirrored nature. As a traditional Southern conservative, Bradford was sometimes considered an embarrassment by Republican moderates and neoconservatives. The political lines were drawn most sharply in early 1981, when word got out that President Reagan was planning to appoint Bradford to be director of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The successful campaign to smear him in order to advance the candidacy of William J. Bennett is well known, even if the definitive account of that whole sorry incident has yet to be written. Because of the controversy, Bradford became a symbol, and I would say a reluctant symbol, of the schism between neoconservatives and the old right. He was a reminder that that schism, although primarily political, has cultural implications as well. Sanford Pinsker and others have argued that there is a distinctively neoconservative genre of literary criticism. I've written an entire book on the matter myself. In order for this to be true, however, in order for the prefix to have any meaning, there must also be an identifiable paleoconservative criticism with which to contrast it. In the essays I have cited, and in many others not mentioned, including the two mentioned by Tom Landis last night, Mel Bradford helped to define that criticism for our age. One way of measuring the difference between neoconservative criticism and the brand of literary analysis Bradford practiced is to read his essay, The Vocation of Norman Podhoretz. In general, this essay, which is actually an extended review of Podhoretz's The Bloody Crossroads, pays sincere tribute to a neoconservative adversary whom Bradford considered a brilliant critic and fellow warrior against totalitarianism. As firm as he was in his principles, Bradford was a man of great generosity and did not see literary criticism as a vehicle for settling personal scores. In two places, however, he establishes a crucial difference between himself and Podhoretz. First, Bradford calls Podhoretz's essay on The God That Failed anachronistic. He argues that that book's account of disillusionment with communism holds little interest for those, and I quote, those of us whose early education was not shaped by a passionate and monolithic commitment to the left, whose friends, teachers, and families never succumbed to the charms of an alien ideology or followed Stephen Dedalus in rejecting nation, kindred, and church, end quote. Later on in the essay, Bradford contends that, quote, there is some myopia implicit in the neoconservative critique of the counterculture, myopia with respect to literary and cultural history, end quote. Although Podhoretz sometimes seemed to suggest that opposition to the adversary culture came only from bourgeois sources, Bradford reminds us that, quote, the most devastating critique of alienation, qua crusade, issues from pre-capitalist roots. After all, most of our forefathers sought out the New World not to start a business, but to acquire land and the status of freeholder, from pieties which are recognized even in New York as different. Over 60 years ago, the agrarian movement was regarded by many as a quaint anachronism. Today, it is easy to dismiss the neo-Confederate vision of M.E. Bradford similarly out of step with the modern age. Just as the agrarians were powerless to reverse the tide of industrialism, Bradford could hardly hope to reverse the centralization of government that had taken place in this country since the war between the states. Expansive interpretations of the 14th Amendment and of the power of the federal government to regulate interstate commerce virtually nullified the states' rights provisions of the 10th Amendment. Moreover, at least since the time of the New Deal, the federal government has become more oppressive by levying ever higher taxes and then remitting part of that revenue to the states with all sorts of strings attached. Bradford could bemoan this trend, but he could not stop it. Should we then conclude that his life and writings were in vain? I think not. As T.S. Eliot reminds us, there are no lost causes because there are no gained ones. The value of the agrarians lay not in the success or failure of their program, but in their prophecy of what would happen if the nation continued its headlong plunge toward industrialization. They were able to make this prophecy precisely because they did not have to weigh their chances for success before determining what they believed. For much the same reason, Mel Bradford was a prophet. By the 1980s, most Americans knew that the federal government was out of control, but they would have been hard-pressed to say when things began to go wrong. Bradford's philosophy of government enabled him to answer that question. Those who would hesitate to endorse his particular answer, and this includes many who call themselves conservative, are obliged to come up with a better one. In order to do so, however, they would have to have an understanding of constitutional law and American history equal to Bradford's own. That is a tall order indeed. Emmy Bradford was a multiculturalist in the same sense that his mentor Donald Davidson was. Both men believed that the variety and richness of American life flourished best when the federal government was least intrusive in the affairs of individual communities and regions. A little over a year ago, I participated in a forum on multiculturalism at Converse College in Spartanburg. I shocked the audience when I said that I would like to see a multiculturalism so broad-minded that it would once again be socially acceptable to fly the Confederate flag. I think Mel Bradford would agree. The last time I saw him alive was in Baton Rouge, the conference to honor the legacy of the agrarians and distributists. That evening, he was leading the conferees in a rousing chorus of his beloved Dixie. One has to believe that in some corner of heaven, where the Confederate flag has yet to be banned, he and Mr. Davidson are singing still.